You're listening to the Tupton Children Podcast.
So let's generate our motivation. And how often during the day do we remember that we're in cyclic existence in samsara? Does that thought come to mind very often? Or are most of our thoughts just about what we have to do today, what we want, what we like, what we don't like, what other people think about us, what they said to us? How often do we really think, oh, I'm in a cycle of repeatedly uncontrolled rebirth that's under the influence of afflictions and karma? And where birth, aging, sickness, and death are my constant companions. How much do we look around at the environment and the people around us and think, oh, all these people are in samsara? Do they even recognize it? Do we even recognize it? So the more we can familiarize ourselves with that thought so that it arises frequently during the day, then the more the response to that thought will also arise, which is, I need to focus on getting myself out of samsara. And then hopefully that will lead us to wish the same for all other living beings, and then to generate the bodhicitta that wants to not only get ourselves out of samsara, but develop all of the qualities necessary best to help others do so. It all starts with remembering what our situation is and having that very clear in our mind, because that changes the whole way we approach the day and the whole way we think about the people that we encounter during the day, as well as the situations we encounter. So here we have a situation of listening to the teachings. So let's generate the proper motivation for doing so. So, do you find during the day, if when you have the thought, oh, I'm in cyclic existence and so are the people around me, does that change how you look at the people around you? Does it change how you feel about yourself? Yeah. It should. It should. Yeah. If it doesn't, then we haven't really understood what cyclic existence is in a personal way. You know, we've only thought of it intellectually. But when we really think of it in a personal way, you know, oh, this is the situation I'm in right now. Yeah, totally under the control of ignorance and afflictions and karma. Yeah, just being a karmic bubble, you know, of five aggregates that have been designated as a person that I totally misapprehend and think, is a real me. How much do we think about that during the day? And how much do we just go on automatic? I want this, I want that, I don't like this, I don't like that. What does this person think of me? What do I think of them? How about this, how about that? Oh, I gotta feed the turkeys. Why don't the turkeys feed me? Oh, they used to feed me, but then I became a vegetarian. That's good. And sometimes, gee, I want to go and have some turkey at Thanksgiving with my family. I better not think thoughts like that. That's not so good. Well, let's think about something else. Well, how about that movie that I saw 15 years ago last time I went to the theater? Oh, that was a long time ago. Yeah? And how much do we, you know, really think, oh, I'm under, you know, I'm a karma bubble, you know, that thinks it's a real person. That's being like a bull in a china shop with my self-centered mind just, you know, bumping into everything that's around me, saying, you better do it my way or else. Yeah, and how often do we really think, oh, you know, my mind's totally out of my control. It's under the control of ignorance and karma. What's happening to me is, you know, under the control of ignorance and karma. You know, those latencies. Those beep, beep, beep latencies, you know. What are they doing to me? What are these latencies anyway? Okay, you know, but really trying to, you know, see what our situation is from our gut feeling. And then looking at all the people around us who are merrily going about their day and, oh, I'm planning for the weekend, I'm planning this great vacation, and yeah, I'm going to stop at the bakery on the way home, and, you know, what football game is playing this weekend, and what's the latest Donald Trump joke? I wish it wasn't. I wish people realized what a joke he was. I mean, is that what's going through our mind? Or are we really kind of thinking about the situation we're in? So the more we can be aware of just being in samsara, the more are the usual things that bug us and irritate us just kind of, we don't have time for them anymore because they're really so silly. Compared with being in samsara, our usual problems are pretty, really silly. But our mind, of course, makes them. Such a great value. And so try during the day, you know. Yeah. Set your alarm clock, your little, you know, on your tablet. Yeah. Or every time you hear the bell, although of course they don't ring bells around here. Do we? Oh, I never hear them. Too much chatter going on inside. To listen to what's going on outside. Yeah, but to, you know, have that memory of I'm in samsara. Everybody else around me is samsara, you know. We're all just a bunch of karmic bubbles. There's no real people here. So that it's very helpful to, even if it's just intellectual, to it's right now, it changes how we interact with the world, doesn't it? Okay. So the last couple of weeks, the Karja the four ways of gathering followers, yeah, and then the four special qualities, which are
truth,
generosity,
tranquility and wisdom.
Okay. And so we've finished that, right? And then we talked about those who speak in a beneficial way are very rare, and even more rare are those who listen, and even rarer than that are those who act on good advice. Yeah, how true, isn't it? And we talked about how if something's unpleasant, even if it's good in the long run, we should do it. Yeah, because if we don't do something simply because it's unpleasant, then that would be like, you know, I don't know, you have some medical problem and you don't want to have the treatment because the treatment's unpleasant, so you'd rather die. Rather silly, isn't it? And then the last bit was about continually reflecting on impermanence. The impermanence of life, health, and political power. Yeah, and in that way, turning the mind to the Dharma. Okay, so now we start a new section. So this section here, in the previous section, he talked about good qualities to develop, things to do. Here he's talking about things to abandon. So forsake the causes of lower rebirth. And so he explained previously in both chapter 1 and earlier in chapter 2 the causes of an upper rebirth, so we will know what to practice and also what to avoid. Okay, and now he's going to go into a little bit more detail about causes of lower rebirth. Okay, so he's going to talk about the disadvantages of intoxicants, gambling, sexual lust, and hunting. And he's picking out those four as things that many people do that really make a mess in their lives now and propel them to create a lot of negative karma, which then becomes the cause of lower rebirths. So I'll warn you that he's going to go in, I don't know if you've read ahead or not.
Yes.
You have. Okay. So, yeah. So it's interesting how it follows on Friday nights, that's Friday night's teachings. This wasn't planned at all. You know, it happened. But it's, making a point. So 144. Seeing that you will definitely die, and that when dead you suffer from your negativity, do not engage in any negativity, even for the sake of temporary pleasure. How true, isn't it? Yeah. You know, after we die, we're going to experience the results of what we do, and so it's better not to engage in any negativity now. Yeah. Even for the sake of temporal pleasure. That even for the sake of temporal pleasure is the hard part. Because, you know, not engage in any negativity, we all agree on that. Yeah, definitely I want to stop engaging in negativity. But when push comes to shove and there's negativity, you know, there's negativity together with immediate pleasure versus no negativity but that lack of immediate pleasure. Which one do we usually go for?
Immediate pleasure.
So, you know, they've done studies among children, and the children who can hold out for future pleasure actually wind up doing better in their lives than the children who are constantly controlled by, there's pleasure right now, I've got to have it. Yeah. Because even in this life, yeah, if we're always seeking immediate pleasure, then even as a kid, we're not going to do our homework. We're not going to eat nourishing food. We're not going to do anything that's good for us, because the mind's only focused on, you know, I want my Twinkies, and I want my tablet, and I want my, you know, baseball and football and, you know, whatever it is, okay? So just this thing, even in this life, learning to not go immediately for pleasure. And it's interesting, even when we eat, you know, do we eat the stuff we don't like first and save the best for last? Or do we eat what we like first and then save the rest for the last? How many of you save the best for the last? Okay, interesting. Probably why you're monastics. Yeah, because I really see with the inmates I write to, what's very difficult for them, first of all, sometimes is making the link between cause and effect. But second of all, when they receive some harm, it's very difficult to refrain from immediately, you know, taking action on it. You know, they immediately have to. Somebody said something you don't like, you immediately have to stop them from doing that. Yeah. So the thing of the temporal pleasure, yeah, or at least the pleasure that comes from releasing the pain of what somebody's done is so difficult to control. Yeah. And then that gets people in a lot of problems. It's not only inmates. I mean, this is the way of our society nowadays. And we're really all taught, go for the pleasure first. Think about the consequences later. Aren't we? Yeah? I mean, that's what advertising is all about. Spend more money than you have. And don't worry about being in credit card debt. Yeah? Sell your life away to the credit card people, but go for the immediate pleasure. Whereas years ago, when some of us were kids, remember there were layaway plans and you had to save before you could get the object? Yeah, so there was delayed gratification and you had to work for it. And now people have no thought like that. It's just, I want it. Even if I can't afford it, doesn't matter. Get it. They pay. How much is the interest rate on credit cards now?
19% at least.
Yeah, at least 10% probably.
Or 19.
19?
Sure.
Really? Oh, yeah. Even as 19% per month.
19.
It's like, well, it doesn't matter. I want it. Let's get it. You know? And then, you know, within what, 5 months, you're paying for 2 of the things. Yeah? So, okay. So here, very practical advice from Nagarjuna. You know, just, it works, it applies to our daily life, and it applies to, you know, our situation in samsara to refrain from negativity. If that's going to be, you know, if we're creating the cause for our own future suffering. Then 145, in some cases the dire result of negativity is not observed. In other instances, the dire result is observed. If there is comfort in one, why do you have no fear? Okay, so here what it's talking about is is sometimes we don't experience the bad result of something in this life, you know, and it's going to be experienced in a future life. So we feel kind of comfortable and secure that the results of our negativities aren't being seen in this life. But if that's the case, shouldn't we be afraid of them being experienced in others, in future lives, especially when we see people who have done similar things to what we've done experience the results of those same actions right now? So if we've created a lot of negativity, yet we're very healthy, why don't we become a lot, you know, concerned when we see our friends have very severe health problems, knowing that we've created the cause for those kinds of things too? Okay? So, he's advising us not to commit negativities and implicitly advising us to do virtuous actions. Okay? So prostrations, circumambulations, Dharma study, making offerings, meditation, and so on. Okay? So just because we're not experiencing any pain now doesn't justify becoming complacent and thinking, well, I just don't have any negative karma, that's why everything's great. Or thinking, oh, you know, I created some negative karma, but see, it's not even ripening now, so, you know, I've put off a long time. Yeah, then we become quite complacent, you know, and a bit haughty. So instead we should, really think about karma and its effects and live our life according to that belief. Okay, so he's telling this to the king especially because people who have a lot of power in society very often have more ability to do more negativity. Yeah. And so you see that, you know, political leaders, they have a lot of power. It's easy to abuse it. People who are in the finance and different corporations, they have a lot of economic power. Again, easy to abuse it. So he's kind of warning the king. And everybody, you know, like that. And us as well, even though we see we don't have as much power as those people do, we sure have enough power to create a lot of negativity, don't we? Yeah. So out of compassion, warning us. So, you know, when these sages warn us and talk to us about karma, we shouldn't see it as, oh, they're badgering me. They're saying, you know, don't do this and don't do that. Not just don't do, you can't do this and you can't do that because I said so. Yeah. I mean, if you take what Nagarjuna is saying or any, you know, of these writers as kind of laying some kind of authoritarian trip of don't you dare do this on us, then we've completely misunderstood what they're doing, you know, because in fact, what they're, I mean, they don't need to warn us about these things. You know, they could just say, well, you know, Buddha said it, let them read what the Buddha wrote. Yeah. But, you know, why do they remind us? Because they have compassion for us and know that, you know, we need to hear it many times and that sometimes we don't get around to reading what the Buddha said and, you know, we have doubts and so on. So they remind us. So we should see these kind of reminders as something they're doing motivated by compassion, not out of, you know, authority trips. Okay, so then let's see here the first thing Nagarjuna is going to rope, you know. Tell us, from intoxicants come the world's disdain. your own failure and the loss of your wealth. Confused, you do what you should not. Therefore, always refrain from intoxicants. But, it helps me relax. And it helps me think creatively, especially when I smoke dope or drop acid. You know, I think so creatively, it's really good. And alcohol, it just loosens me up, helps me make friends. Shouldn't I have friends? That way I can spread the Dharma to more people. And then also, you know, when I go to my family dinners, I need to drink because everybody at the family is drinking. And if I don't drink with my family, or if I go to a party with my friends and I don't drink, they're all going to look at me and say, oh, are you some kind of prude doing some kind of holy trip looking down on us? Yeah? And they won't like me and they'll accuse me of being holier than thou. That's no fun. And anyway, everybody always meets at the pub. So how am I going to get any days if I don't go to the bar? Yeah, I'm not going to meet any dates, I'm not going to make any friends if I just go to the newsstand. You know, if I go to the bar, I'll meet somebody. Of course, I can always go on these dating sites, yeah, and sign up for that. But, you know, you don't really know if the person really is who they say they are. Yeah? And they put a picture of what they looked like 20 years ago. And when you meet them, they don't look like that anymore. So, quite the bar is better, you know. Then I relax, I'm out of the house, I make friends. And what's wrong with it anyway? What's wrong with it? It comes from fruit. And you're always telling me fruit is good for my body. And actually, some of the doctors have done, the researchers have done some study, and they say a little bit of wine every day is good for your heart. So I keep thumping. So it sounds good, doesn't it? I hear this story so much because many people come and they ask to take the precepts, but then want to take the four precepts. Maybe some of you did that. You know? They want to take four precepts. So then I say, okay, you can take four. And the others here will take five, and then you can go out and get drunk and celebrate, because we're creating virtue. They kind of giggle about that. But, you know, oh, so many reasons why I can't give up drinking and drugging. Yeah? It's amazing. But, okay, what is Nagarjuna saying about drinking and drugging? From intoxicants come the world's disdain. Why does the world have disdain?
Because you're such a jerk.
Because you what?
Because you're such a jerk when you're drunk.
Because you're such a jerk when you're drunk. Exactly. Exactly. I mean, the people, I mean, first of all, we act like jerks when we're intoxicated, yeah? And it's also amazing, I mean, with the guys that we write to who are in prison, I would say 99.9 of them were intoxicated when they committed their crime. Yeah? So that kind of gets you the world's disdain. Of course, with some people, it gets you their pop, you know, they think you're great, you drink and drug together with them, and, you know, and you deal a little bit, and they think you're great, you're a real good friend, but, you know, after a while, it's like you go down, you're like Alice going down the hole, except you know, you meet these monsters there instead of Winnie the Pooh. Winnie the Pooh wasn't that. Well, they all kind of
they all kind of merged together.
Borrowing money from your housemates or your parents or your relatives, and then you stop borrowing it and you just take it because you think it should be yours anyway. And then you start pawning the family's things, and you know, maybe start dealing yourself just to get the money. So it's, it turns out a big mess.
Can you also remind people about smoking?
Yeah, also about smoking. So smoking is considered an intoxicant, yeah. And so here, you chase away your friends. I mean, really, for me, if I'm around people, some people, you know how they have the smell of cigarettes, the smell of tobacco? I really can't stand being around him. And I remember one time somebody had asked for a private appointment and he came. It was like he just reeked of tobacco, and it was really hard for me to stay in the room and talk to him because he smelled so bad, you know. So there's that. Plus, I mean, it's habit, it's addictive, isn't it? Yeah, and you spend so much money on cigarettes, actually on all the drugs. Yeah, the next thing he said, your own failure, but also the loss of your wealth. Yeah, buying cigarettes, buying alcohol, buying drugs.
And your health. And your health.
It's coming. Your health and your wealth. Yeah, your health really goes down the tubes. And they're having, this big epidemic almost of death from heroin overdoses. And it's only because it's happening in white middle class communities that they're starting to see it now as a public health problem, not as a criminal problem. And I think of how many people are sitting in prison because, they were minorities and they were arrested for the same thing that now people are, see as a public health problem. But what's nice is there's some police departments, a few of them who are beginning to say, look, if you're addicted to something, come in and we will help you. We will find you a treatment program and we won't arrest you. And they say this publicly in the communities, and it's really helped because some people have actually come in. Okay, but your health, your wealth goes down, your health, from lung cancer to cirrhosis of the liver to everything else in between. And not to mention, just the danger of overdose. And I was blown away by when I learned that more people in this country die of overdose of prescription drugs than they do of illegal drugs. Okay, and then of course, what does this do to your family when they find you and you've overdosed? Then confused? Yeah, sure are confused when we're intoxicated. You do what you should not do. We say all sorts of things when we're high, don't we? That afterwards we go, oh my goodness, did I say that? Did I do that? And I'm going to weigh in on something that some people may not agree with, okay, being intoxicated is no excuse for somebody to rape you, because they're having a lot of discussion about date rape and rape on campuses. So just because somebody's intoxicated doesn't mean raping them is okay. Okay, definitely not. However, I think people can protect themselves from getting raped by not getting intoxicated. So, of course, blaming the victim and saying, you were intoxicated, you deserved it, you were intoxicated, it's your fault, that's not right. But I think, people can get smart and not do things that put us in dangerous situations. So you don't blame the victim, but realize you have some power yourself to make yourself into a victim. I'm sure I'll get a flood of letters after this. Are you saying that? No, I'm not saying that. But I am saying that, we can protect ourselves.
This is where the cooperative conditions become a crucial piece on whether karma ripens or karma ripens.
Exactly, yeah. Very good point, yeah. Because when you're intoxicated, you're setting up the cooperative conditions for negative karma to ripen. If you have some negative karma that could easily ripen in a car accident, drinking is going to help that karma ripen, isn't it? So, to think about that. Okay, so your body and your health decrease. Sometimes you neglect your appearance, you become disheveled, you get involved in activities that are really stupid. Okay, say all sorts of things that we wish we hadn't said afterwards. I won't tell you any personal stories with this verse, although I could. So alcohol presents higher risk for cancer. And also, women drinking when they're pregnant is horrible for fetal alcohol syndrome. It's horrible. It just really, it destroys the kid's life even before they're born. Yeah. So. Yeah, so, you know, people who committed suicide when they were very intoxicated, yeah.
And others who died in car wrecks.
Yeah, and others, yeah. I will tell you one story, yeah. I spoke with one woman, and she was telling me, because her husband liked to drink, and so, in their house, he had all these liquor bottles. You know how some people like to collect liquor bottles? So he had all these liquor bottles, you know, kind of on the shelves going around, kind of like, you know, a decoration in the house. And so because the father liked to drink, the son learned to drink. And this woman told me that one day her son was driving. He hit somebody, killed four people in the car crash, and put himself into a coma because he was so severely injured. And then the parents were faced with the decision of what to do with a child who is hooked up to a ventilator and hooked up to all these other, you know, life prolonging things. And it was torture for the parents, yeah. Do you keep your child on that and the hope that he will wake up from a coma? Meanwhile, you know, you're not rich and all your money's going into that. But the thought of pulling the plug on your own child is like horrible. So she told me eventually they decided to pull the plug. And just, I mean, how excruciating that was to do that for their own child. And how when her husband came home after that and looked at all the bottles on the wall, he just went like that, you know. Because he realized that he played some role in his son's death. Very sad. So now we understand why there's the fifth precept. Yeah? Okay, then the verse 147 is gambling. So gambling causes attachment, unpleasantness, and anger. Deception, trickery, and an occasion for wildness. Lying, pointless chatter, and harsh speech. Therefore, always refrain from gambling. Okay, so here he mentions 9 disadvantages of gambling. Okay, so attachment, you become greedy for others' wealth. Okay, unpleasantness, you worry about whether you're going to win or lose, and that makes your mind quite uneasy and unpleasant. Anger, yeah, You get overwhelmed by unhappiness and anger when you lose. Deception and trickery, so you resort to deception and trickery in order to win. Okay, when you gamble, your mind and your behavior become quite excited and wild. Yeah, your speech gets uncontrolled, so there's lots of pointless chatter. There's lots of harsh speech. Yeah. And you lose your money. He didn't mention that here, did he? You lose your money, because no way are you going to win. Otherwise, they wouldn't have casinos. Yeah, because if you were going to win, the casinos couldn't stay in business. So for sure you're going to lose. Yeah, but we're like those mice that keep pecking on something. This time I'm going to win. I'll put my quarters in this machine long enough, and then eventually, I'll win something. So it really, it makes a big mess. I had a friend in Singapore, her brother gambled, really had a horrible effect on the family. Because it gets everybody else in the family involved in it, and the deception, often deceiving other members of the family in order to get the money to go gambling, lying to family members and friends. Yeah, big problem. I'll tell you a story now. So, when I was a little kid, my dad would do certain things with the boys sometimes. So they had this poker thing. And I think once a week or once every 2 weeks they would play poker. And they would go from one guy's house to the other guy's house, So one day they were having it at our house, We kids all, we had to go to bed early when, they were coming. So they had the poker thing at our house. And then the next morning when I went for breakfast, because they would play around the kitchen table, and there was, a wall behind the kitchen table. And there was all this goo on the wall behind the kitchen table. I said, what happened? Well, apparently they were playing poker, I don't know if they were drinking. My dad wasn't, he didn't drink very much, but maybe the other guys did. But anyway, one of them said something really obnoxious, this thing of harsh speech. And my mother had, had a cake that she was cutting up to serve them, as the hostess. But this guy made such an obnoxious remark, she threw the cake at him. It was all the gooey white frosting on the wall the next morning. So, that's really a disadvantage, isn't it? That you lose your cake. Okay. Then, the next verse, 148, now we're getting into a whole section about lust, okay, and the disadvantages of lust and what goes on. So 148, most attachment to women comes from the belief that women's bodies are pure, but in actuality there is no purity in a woman's body at all. Okay, so Kensa Rinpoche, by this time, by the time he's teaching this, he's been teaching in the West some time. So he knows that he better make some qualifications about this verse. Yeah. So he said we should understand, when it says women, we should understand women, for example. Because first of all, Nagarjuna is talking to a king who presumably is heterosexual, and assuming that later on monks who are celibate and heterosexual, you know, although that's not necessarily true, the heterosexual part, they better be celibate, but that they will be, listen, you know, reading this. So he talks about women, but, you know, it applies equally to men and it applies equally to our own bodies. And if you read in chapter 8, Shamyadeva's engagement in bodhisattva's deeds, same kind of discussion, you know. So really seeing that they're talking about the antidote to sexual desire, you know, according to the audience, which in those days was principally men. So I thought it will be interesting, as we're reading the verses, that sometimes we say men and sometimes we say women. Because there's probably a bunch of different people who are listening to the teaching. There's men and women, and there's gays and straights. So I can't just say one thing, because one won't fit everybody. So, you know, we'll try it out, kind of seeing how changing the genders. And then the guys can have a little bit of reflection how it feels. Okay. Yeah. And he also goes on here to explain how women are very important in Tantra, and there's a Tantra precept to not disparage women, and that, you know, the Vinaya sets up you know, a Bhikshuni order as well as a Bhikshu order. Those are both available. And then he talks also about the kindness of the mother. You know, that's talked about in the Dharma. Okay. So, you know, in order to show that this verse is not speaking specifically about women or, you know, dissing women in general. Okay. But talking about the unclean nature of whoever it is that we're sexually attracted to, that there's no purity at all in that person's body, okay? So, you know, when you feel sexual desire arising, if you start, you know, thinking about the nature of the body, your desire goes away real quick. Yeah, this is actually a technique that does work if you really stay with it. Because we always think of our body as clean and beautiful. Yeah, and that's what allows desire to arouse for another person's body. You know, because especially we think their body is really clean and really beautiful. But as soon as we actually look at what it is, it becomes a little bit less desirable. Okay? So let's see what the body is. And all he's doing here is describing the body for what it is. You know, if at any point you think he's saying something that is false, then say so. Okay? But if he's saying what's true, then take it to heart. Okay? So his mouth is a vessel of impurity with putrid saliva and gunk between his teeth. His nose is a pot of snot, phlegm, and mucus, and his eyes contain eye slime and tears. True or false?
True.
Okay. It's really true, isn't it? The mouth is a vessel of impurity with putrid saliva and gunk between his teeth. It's true. Yeah. And the nose, of course, you know, all this junk comes out of it. And then even your eyes, which are like diamonds, you know, excrete all this kind of slime. Yeah. And your teeth, you know, your teeth, which are like pearls, have gunk between them. And your ears, which are like, what are ears like? I don't know.
Seashells.
Seashells. Your ears, which are like seashells. You know, have earwax coming out of them. Okay. So, nothing terribly beautiful about any of that, is it? And this is just basically the meditation, one of the meditations we do when we do mindfulness of the body. You know, we have the establishments four establishments of mindfulness on the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. So on the body, we look at what the body is. So one of the meditations we do, and we have fun with this. Remember some years ago? Fun. We memorized all the 32, you know. Head, hair, body, hair, nail, teeth, skin.
Muscle,
tendons, bones.
Marrow, kidney.
Okay.
Heart.
Heart.
Which one goes in there? Connective tissue.
Heart, liver, connective tissue.
Spleen. Lungs.
Lungs. Okay, that was the third.
Is it the liquid?
Fourth.
No.
Yeah, then the.
Oh, no, it's not the bowels.
Yeah. Bowels and.
Gorge. Feces.
Yeah.
Brain.
Feces. Brain.
Yeah, brain.
Bile.
Yeah, bile.
Phlegm.
Urine.
No, phlegm. Pus.
Phlegm. Pus.
Blood.
Sweat.
Fat.
Urine's got to be in there.
No,
somewhere.
Urine's at the very, towards the end.
Oh.
Oil in the joints.
Oh, yeah. The oil in the joints. And
fat,
your feet.
Tears,
your feet.
Fast. Tears. Grease.
Fat, tears.
Spit.
Grease.
Spit.
Yeah. Spit.
Oil the joints, urine.
The oil in the joints.
Wow.
Okay, good God. Yeah, you should sing your...
I do the meditation.
What?
Did I do the meditation?
Good, yeah.
I think the song, too.
Yeah.
Huh? Venerable Chitty's song about...
Yes, her song. She'll have to do that. Yeah, but it's very effective, you know, because you see what the body is, and that it's basically like a garbage bag that's full of disgusting stuff that's smooth and soft to the touch. Yeah, but it's a garbage bag. It's like a garbage bag that's tied at both ends with all this junk inside. But the garbage bag, you know, is like painted this pretty color and it's kind of feels soft to touch. But I mean, inside it's just all this really putrid, disgusting stuff. Isn't it?
That's what
it's
when we look at it.
Yeah? I mean, if we look at it, if you're somewhere where there's been an accident and somebody's bleeding, or, you know, there was an explosion and there's parts of the body anywhere, people just scream in horror. It's, you know, yeah, they faint. They even faint. So, you know, it's not like, this is so beautiful. Like unknowing persons who have become attached to an ornamented vessel filled with filth, ignorant and confused worldly beings are attached to women. Okay? So if you're attached, if you have sexual desire for somebody, you're not going to be free of attachment. And your sexual desire, it's the strongest desire we have. And it's like a donkey with a ring in its nose. And it leads you all around to do all sorts of things. And the games we play, and the trips we play, yeah, for an ornamented vessel filled with filth. Okay, so we are ignorant and confused worldly beings. So Just thinking about what the body is should actually evoke non-attachment in us. Yeah, if we had any wits about us, seeing a body would evoke blah. Yeah. But we're so confused that seeing a body invokes I want. Yeah. Even though it doesn't, it's not like really realizing emptiness, you know, where you have to use all kinds of logical reasons to understand it. Seeing the body is, you know, just disgusting stuff we can see with our eyes, and yet we can't see it. Yeah? So you have all these people, you know, like when they do, what is it, like the Oscars and the Emmys and the all these kind of award things, you know? It always cracks me up. The women try and wear as little as possible, and the men are wearing as much as possible with these things that choke them up here and long sleeve shirts and layers on, you know, and the women, it's like I have hardly anything on. I don't know how they set the thermostat so people have to roll these kind of events, you know. And then people want to, the big thing is to stand on the red carpet and have some guy take your picture while you're going like this or this. Or, you know, I don't, God, the guy stand. You know, I mean, yeah. And then you're famous and everybody looks at your body and what you're wearing or what you're not wearing, and then you think, I must be a good person. Yeah? Does having everybody look at your body make you a good person? If that's the basis of your self-esteem, you're not going to have any as time goes on, because all of us are getting older and uglier. It's a fact. Just as filth-loving pigs are greatly attached to heaps of feces and urine. You ever watch pigs in a pigsty? Have you ever smelled pigs in a pigsty? So too are desirous people greatly attached to heaps of feces and urine, like filth-loving pigs. So if you see a boy pig and a girl pig, you know, and they have desire for each other, you know, they're doing their little thing, what pigs do. Yeah? Do you feel any desire? You know? I mean, if you're usually attached to men or women or whatever it is, do you feel attached for the girl pig or the boy pig?
No.
Yeah. But the other pig feels really attached. But we don't feel attached because it's a pig. Okay. But what's the difference between the pig's body and the body of the human being that we're sexually attracted? Pig's body, you can make into bacon and pork and, you know, you can't do that with a human body. But it's the same thing. The mind that's attracted is the same thing, like one pig being sexually attracted to another pig. The mind is the same. And basically, consider what the body is like. It's like being attracted to pigs. Laughing. Okay, 154. Foolish persons imagine that the city of bugs that is the body with cavities that are sources of filth is something conducive to pleasure. Okay, so our body is filled with all sorts of worms and microbes and all sorts of stuff. Okay, it has many cavities that are the source of filth. Actually, you know, our whole digestive system is actually outside of our body. Yeah, it's just a tube running through. And all the tissue on the digestive system is the same as, it's related to the skin tissue, isn't it? We call it epithelial? Yeah, it has some relationship to skin tissue because your whole inside lining is the lining. This is the outside of your body. Because what goes through that whole tube is actually outside of your body, even though it's inside your body. Are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah? Okay. So within those cavities, yeah, in our whole digestive system, yeah, we look at some food and like, that's so beautiful. And then you put it in the mouth and you chew it. If somebody chewed it and spit it out, is that food so beautiful? No. After they swallow it, and it makes it into the stomach, then what does it look like? Well, we've seen what that looks like when we throw up. Yeah. Then it goes from your stomach into your little intestine, and then into your big intestine. And then it comes out. Yeah, that doesn't look so great either. Yeah. So all of our, you know, our cavities, that, you know, our eyes, our ears, our nose, our mouth. Yeah, where we pee, where we poo. If you're a woman, you know, your vagina. Everywhere, stuff comes out that we file. We find unappealing. True or not true? When you yourselves see the impurities of excrement, urine, and such, how can the body being composed of them be something pleasant for you? Okay, so the body, our body is produced from causes. You know, the sperm and egg of our parents, which are filthy in nature, aren't they? So it comes from these dirty substances. So how is the body that comes from them going to be something beautiful? Yeah. But then when you have a baby, the baby's body is so cute and adorable. But what comes out of the baby's body? It's spits, it throws up, it poos, and it pees. And yet we think that baby's body is so adorable. Okay? It is produced by the seed of impure essence, an admixture of ovum and semen. How can the lustful be attached to it when they know its nature is impure? What it is. One who lies with this filthy mass covered with skin moistened by those fluids is doing nothing more than lying on top of a man's bladder. True. Shantideva says that when you want to hug somebody, you might as well hug a pillow. Because a pillow is cleaner than a person. Yeah. He says, what do you want to hug this, you know, bag of junk for? Yeah. It's cleaner to hug a pillow. You know. And then especially, you know, people sweat. Yeah. So this person you're really attracted to, then they sweat. Yeah. sorts of stuff. Okay, so our true grasping mind apprehends the body as truly existent, and on the basis of that, attachment arises. And the, you know, we have the mental factor of inappropriate attention that thinks that something that's foul by nature is beautiful, that gives rise to attachment. And then when we're attached to somebody, we act like turkeys. Yeah? I don't know if in high school, but I remember we had this expression. Sometimes we would call the boys turkeys. Of course, they called us chicks. Yeah. But when you're here, I mean, being here in the springtime and you watch the turkeys, yeah. And that's what human beings act like when they're sexually attracted. So they act like the turkeys. Yeah. So you have all the girl turkeys, they stick together and they're pecking and eating. And the boy turkeys, yeah, are going around, you know, they think they're so good looking. They take their feathers and spread them out. They're nothing compared to peacocks. I mean, a turkey and a peacock, you can't compare. But the boy turkeys think that they are magnificent. And they spread their feathers and they strut around. And they make these noises. Yeah. And then they fight with each other. Oh yeah, their faces turn.
This huge thing over the top of their head comes down over their face.
Yeah, this thing comes down, and does their face? Yeah, their face turns blue, but they get some big thing here and something here. They look, you know, and the girl turkeys just are like, "Who are you, Buster?" And they just totally ignore. And the boy turkeys are just going around like, you know, they're really hot stuff. Yeah. So human beings, sometimes, I mean, here the girl human beings, they put on their, you know, their stuff too, you know, they paint other faces and, you know, do things and what you wear. And the guys put on their stuff and do their stuff. And, you know, and so it's this huge dance. It's this huge kind of game that people play. Yeah. And it's, you can tell when people are playing it. Yeah, can't you? Yeah. You go somewhere and you watch how people talk to each other and you can see, oh, this one's attracted to that one, that one's attracted to this. Because you can see the little games, that what you do to flirt, what you do to attract somebody else to you, you know. You become so animated and so smiley and so gracious and so.
It's a good example of how we think we're thinking our thoughts and our thoughts are actually thinking us. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, when you're in that behavior, you think it's personal. You think, oh, I myself self is, you know, and is attracting this other person, and it's just this set of behaviors.
Okay, well, my thing went ahead. Okay, yeah, so lying on his bladder. 158. Whether it be beautiful or ugly, whether it be young or old, the body of a woman is filthy. So to what special quality could you be attached? Okay. So if you look at each organ of the body, you know, what is it? Oh, your spleen. You have such a wonderful brain. I love your brain. Those gray folds. Yeah? And the bone surrounding it, your lustrous skull with the gray folds inside. Yeah? And the scalp. autopsies are awesome. You really see what it's like. When I was in Thailand, you know, because the monks there go to autopsies as part of their practice. So I, of course, wanted to go. And so they took me, and there was a lay woman who was kind of traveling with me, and then some monks, and we went to this hospital for the autopsy. One of the monks was very concerned that we were going to faint during the autopsy, and that's because he had fainted the first time. So he thought, well, these women are going to faint. And we said, look, we've been with our moms with, you know, dead turkeys and chickens and meat, and, you know, we've handled meat before. We're okay, you know, we're more concerned with you guys fainting. So we went in there. The guy, you know, he had drowned, actually, the day before. He's lying naked on the table. You kind of expect him to roll over and stand up, but he's not. You know, and then they started doing the autopsy. So they cut here and then peel back the scalp. So you really saw what the scalp is, you know, just this piece of skin with this hair. Not very attractive, yeah. And then they take this drill. I don't know if this is how they do it in the US, but this was Thailand. There's this kind of round thing that's spun, and they use that, and they cut, you know, all around here, and then took the skull off, you know, like you're taking off a hat, and then, you know, took the brain out and different things. And they weighed all of them. They had like a scale you have at the grocery store, you know, throw us, you know, his brain in, mark down the weight, throw this in, you know. And then they cut, and they, you know, they cut all the way down here. And it was really something when they reached up here and pulled out, and out came the tongue and the esophagus, you know, through here. And then, you know, opened up the chest, and, you know, all the lungs and all that gunk, and his stomach with the undigested food. And, you know, and so looked at all the organs, weighed the organs, took them out, you know, had to slice some of them. And then when it was all done, yeah, because they have to give the body to the family, they took everything, that all the organs that they had taken out, and they just stuffed them back into the torso. They didn't put it where each organ belongs. They just took it like, together with the newspaper that, you know, it had been, or whatever plastic they were using, everything around, that they just stuffed it back into the body and sewed it up. And then he looked like, and then they were able to give the body to the family. I have pictures if you want to see. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you really see what the body is. You don't get aroused at you know, at an autopsy. It's, you know, it just doesn't do it. Okay, so whether it's young, the body's young or old, whatever it is, you know, what's there to be attached to? Okay, maybe should we stop here? Yeah, there's still several more verses to go. Any questions or comments? We're right in the middle of it, in more ways than one.
This is where intoxicants come in.
Yeah. Where what?
Intoxicants come in.
Yeah.
I just think it's amazing how deluded we can make ourselves. I've a number of times when I'm walking my dog, you'll see some other dog stand there and there's poop on the sidewalk. And it's like, should I, you know, I carry a little bag, should we pick that up? And I think, oh no, somebody else's dog's poop is gross.
But I have no problem picking up on it. Right? So, like, my dog's poop is special, and it's poop. But literally, yeah. I've thought this.
Yeah.
As I'm walking and realizing how insane it is, I mean, yeah. to differentiate like that.
And I've talked to mothers who say that cleaning up their baby's poop, they don't even feel like the baby's poop was dirty. Yeah. Their baby's poop.
Yeah.
Other people's baby's poop. Yeah, so completely illogical. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Does it make you wonder how your mind ever got so crazy?
It makes me sad, though, that to think, just what I was saying before about how, especially when we get into adolescence and we think we're like the first one to ever fall in love that much with another person, and it's just the same old, you know. And it's like, you don't, nobody says, you know, this is just your animal instinct. Watch a couple of National Geographic. You see them.
Yeah.
But we think, oh, my love is so intense, and I'm the first one to ever really feel this much love for another person.
Yeah. And it's at, but, you know, If that person's mind were in a body that looked different, would you still love them the same way? Okay? That person that you fall in love with, if you could take their mind out of that body, put it in the body of whatever sex they're not, and make them 85 years old, are you still going to love that person in the same way? They're 85 years old and are of the opposite sex. Are you going to have the same feeling?
Of course not.
No. No way. So then it's really crazy that you love the person. You know, then you really see how you love them because they're in that body that you're lusting at.
So is this how ignorance plays itself out in the desire realm? Is that we have our senses are driving us so much that we can't perceive how things actually exist, that ignorance is propelling us to see these bodies in the exact opposite way?
Yeah.
In which, is it part of the desire realm appearance that's...
Well, this is the characteristic of the desire realm, that we're so completely overwhelmed by desire for sense objects. So, you know, there's ignorance involved. There's a lot of these four wrong conceptions, you know, which some people call four distortions, four types of inappropriate attention. You know, these things really run the show, so we don't see things accurately at all.
Because to see it laid out like this so clearly, mm-hmm. and then to just go down the street and follow somebody, it's mm-hmm. like... The tracking is totally different from reality.
Yes.
No matter how much you understand it intellectually, you don't get it.
Yeah.
You know, we don't get it.
Yeah, we don't get it. And this is a very good point about, especially this, the difference between intellectually understanding it and really understanding it. You know, because you can hear this teaching, say it's all, you know, yes, perfectly true. And then the next good-looking person you see, you're like this. You know, the mind's completely forgotten. Totally. You know, even if it's 5 minutes later. Yeah. So...
But let's be honest. When you look at somebody, you don't look at a... You don't inside, you know?
No.
You look at the body exterior, the eyes, the smile, the...
Yeah. But even those things, it starts out hair, head, body, hair, nail, teeth, skin. Hair, head, you take the scalp and hang it up.
Yeah, I agree with that, but we don't think of that.
Yeah, we don't at all.
No, we don't. We push it.
Yeah, we don't want to think about it. Somebody brings it up. I remember I taught this one time when I lived in Singapore to some young people, and one of them looked at me and said, "Try this and it works." you know, what about my girlfriend? You know, she doesn't want me to do this meditation. Yeah, and we actually don't want to. Yeah, we don't want to look at the body for what it actually is. Yeah. I mean, even our kitties that we love to hug and pet, yeah, their bodies too. I mean, they have bad breath. They poop, they pee, they throw up fur. And we love to cuddle them. Yeah. So samsara is somewhat of an insane asylum. Isn't it? It's like we're outright crazy. Yeah.
So I'm reading, but listening to this all about sexual desire and then putting it in this context, how would you respond to, you know, people having children?
That's their business. You know, if people want to have kids, they, you know, they can have kids. Yeah. I mean, I'm teaching the Dharma. I'm not going to give personal advice to somebody.
Well, no, I just, in that realm of creating children, knowing that you have this body that is in this description, and yet it's kind of the basis for sexual desire, which is the basis for people getting together, just the basis for having children. Not whether or not to have children, but that's kind of how that all kind of works for lay people. And so I'm just kind of wondering if you have any thoughts on lay people thinking about that.
Well, I think that very much of what people's lives revolve around, sexual desire is at the base of it. Yeah. Because, like I said, that's the most intense desire we have. Yeah. So to get a sexual partner, then you have to have money. You have to have a certain social status. So you need to go to work. You need to get an education. You need to do this and that. You need to buy certain things, look a certain way. You know, there's a whole lot of things that go into this whole game that happens that eventually leads to having kids.
Mm-hmm. But I have asked that question before. If we all stop to procreate, how are we going to have an awakening?
Yeah. People always ask that question. If we, you know, if nobody has babies, then, you know, how will all those people become Buddhists? Let's worry about that problem.
That's what they asked the last time, too.
Yes. Yeah. That is, I don't want to speculate on how to solve that problem. First of all, I don't think that's ever going to happen. And second of all, there's much more pressing problems we have right now than imagining a problem that's not going to happen. Yeah.
It's also interesting how, you know, getting older and being an older woman now, and then look back on my interactions with men, you know, when I was attractive versus what I am now, and it's amazing how pervaded even supposedly non-sexual relationships are.
Completely.
It's just pervaded in there. You know, how people interact with each other, you know, whether they treat you one way or another way, whether they wait on you at the store. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, my sister said it's much harder for her. My sister's only 49, you know, and she looks much younger, but she says it's much harder for her to get customer service at a store now than it was 20 years ago. So she takes her daughter, my niece, who's gorgeous, and then it's easier to get customer service. Yeah. Okay, so we have to stop here. But think about this and do the meditation.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have. stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Bosun's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niryatayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenresi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of
explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Ashravasti Abbey in the West